Welcome to Public Programs at the American Museum of Natural History. For this podcast, neurobiologist Patrick Gannon of Hofstra University's School of Medicine uses, as he puts it, his inferior frontal lobe to deliver the 79th James Arthur Lecture. Over the course of an hour, Gannon gives the listener a quick tour of the history of research into sensory centers of the brain, places the planum temporale, a part of the cortical area initially thought to be uniquely human and associated with language, in context with all other primates, and traces the potential sequence of steps that led to the origin of language among people. So pull out your Gray's Anatomy and listen to this program from March 23, 2009, beginning with an introduction by curator Ian Tattersall of the American Museum of Natural History.
Well, good evening, everybody. My name's Ian Tattersall, and I'm a curator in the anthropology division of this museum, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to the 79th annual James Arthur Lecture on the Evolution of the Human Brain. Our lecturer tonight trained in England and came to the United States initially to found a brain research laboratory at Mount Sinai School of Medicine across the park here in New York City. And he's currently, wears many hats as you can see. He's currently a professor in the Academy of Medical Educators at the Turomed Medical College in New Jersey. But in a month or two, he's going to become the chair of the Department of Basic Sciences at Hofstra Medical School. His work in brain evolution has involved the comparative study of brains all the way across the spectrum of primates, and he's looked at these brains on both a cellular and a gross anatomical level. And over the past decade, he's more and more become focused in upon the so-called language areas of the primate brain. Now, these language areas were once thought to be the unique possession of Homo sapiens, but he and his collaborators have managed to show that they also exist, at least in a precursor form, in a number of other primates as well. And this is a subject he's going to be speaking on today in his talk that's entitled Evolutionary Depth of Human Brain Language Areas, Roles of Common Ancestors, and Major Adaptive Shifts. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Patrick Gannon.
Thank you, Ian. That's very nice. Excellent. So what you're looking at here, it's always a good start, right? Here are some of my friends. Not so much these guys. I don't know who these are. This is Kiko from the National Zoo, Washington. This is Washo, the chimpanzee who died recently. Beautiful animal. Kanzi, I'm going to tell you some good stories about this guy. So I'm going to follow through from this period of evolutionary history all the way down to where we are today. Let me start with this then. I would like to dedicate this presentation to Jane Goodall. I met her recently at this conference, The Mind of the Chimpanzee, in Chicago. She gave a very moving talk. She had me in tears numerous times talking about conservation and the welfare of animals such as chimpanzees, which, as you all know, she loves. And she's the most amazing speaker. If you've ever seen her deliver, bring your napkins, because she's good at it. And we had a very nice chat afterwards, too, and she signed her book for me. She said, the chimpanzee beings, all right, like human beings. So she didn't just say, like, we all know about chimps, chimpanzee beings. So that's kind of her nature, is to do things like that. And also, I've been coming to this lecture for so many years, and I finally read the little article put out by Ian Tattersall about a famous guy who made it all happen. That's why we're here, because of the money that this guy put up front. And you probably looked at him in the little invitation thing that you get. But just look at what he did. He actually got interested in the brain, and I'm going to tell you a little bit later what I think is, think of why he may have gotten interested in the brain. He was an engineer with bucks, and then he came to the Museum of Natural History, and he dedicated a lot of money to keep this lecture series going. And it's such a privilege. I mean, look at these names. If you know these names, it's like, whoa. I'm gushing when I look at them, starting with Fred Tilney back in 1932. That's a long time ago. I forget his name. Marshak. He was the guy who did the Neanderthal and the Homo sapiens, like phases of the moon. Do you know that work? Alexander, that's his name. Incredible guy. There's some big names here. It's kind of scary to be on this list, but it makes me very proud. So let me take you back to the beginning of this then. Fred Tilney, first James Arthur lecturer, 1932. I'll tell you later about this guy. It was fascinating. He had Broca's aphasia like a few years before he gave this lecture. And this is what he said. The brain of modern man is only, and should have said human, brain of modern man is only some intermediate stage in the ultimate development of the master organ of life. When man's brain finally bursts into full bloom, whenever that might be, depressions and wars will disappear. 1932, remember? We will be, by conscious command, evolved cerebral centers which will permit us to use powers that we are now not even capable of imagining. What a beautiful thing to get this started with, right? So now, there's the human brain. This is your brain. It's the left side. I'm going to talk to you about the different areas that are doing what we're doing right now, is speaking and listening. But first, let's just go down here. Frontal lobe, that's the front of your brain. This is the inferior frontal lobe, which is where I'm going to be talking to you about. That's where I'm speaking from right now because I'm right-handed. Parietal lobe, that's important too, because all of this area here, a lot of brain evolution people have worked on this area because this really captures what it's like to be a human. That's where associations happen. That's where pieces are put together to make the final solutions. The parietal lobe is an integration center. Occipital lobe, this is where you see things, and all of that information can come forward here. And remember, when you see things, you're reading, looking at things, you're looking at people's facial expressions. So all of these things are coming in for communication. It's not just speaking and hearing. There's a lot of things going on. Temporal lobe, this is where the action is right here. I'm going to be telling you about this because that's like at the center of the research that I've been doing on chimpanzee brains. So now, let's talk about the big guys. Broca, Paul Pierre Broca. And this is why he became famous. Le Bon, I can't even say it in the true French. If you can speak French, you're a lot better than me. Le Bon. Because the only thing he could say was tan, tan, tan all day long. Because he had a big lesion here, he had neurosyphilis, he'd been a naughty guy, and he got a big lesion here and he died eventually of it. But that's what finally led Broca to realize that that's the seat of spoken language right there, and it became called Broca's area. Like 14 years later, Carl Wernicke did a similar thing based on lesions in this region of the brain. So that's Wernicke's area. That's perceived area of the brain. You're using it right now if you're right-handed. Most of you probably are, 75%. Hearing me and making sense of what I'm saying right here. That's Wernicke's area, and he knew that because if you couldn't, you can hear just fine, but if you couldn't understand language, you have Wernicke's aphasia. And the same here. You know what you want to say, and you could sign what you could want to say, you can write what you want to say, but you just couldn't say it. That's Broca's aphasia. So now let's go to the next step, Corbinian Brodmann. We still say Brodmann's area, 44, 45. We put numbers, he put numbers, he looked at the cellular identity of these regions, and he said, well, if it looked like this, give it a number. If it doesn't look like that, give it another number. So he made Brodmann's areas all over the brain. These are the language areas. This is like where you, this is a motor area, which is where you make things happen with your hands and your legs. But that doesn't matter, because here, down here, is where you make your larynx work, your mouth work, your tongue work for speech. And what makes that happen for speech is the area 44 and 45. In another term, this is called pars opercularis, pars triangularis, and pars orbitalis. And the reason it's called orbitalis is because it's right over your orbit, right here, your eye. Here, this bump here and here, that's where you're hearing things, mostly on the left and the right. But if you want to make sense of it with respect to language, you send that information, that's called Heschel's gyrus. If you want to make sense of it, you send it to here, that's an association area, that feeds into the inferior parietal region. Remember I told you about that? 41, 42, this is association regions, angular gyrus, supramarginal gyrus. It's easy to remember. Supramarginal is around the margin. But this is like, you know, Heschel's gyrus and primary auditory cortex. But the way things are going these days all over the research, we called it way back when, we called it auditory cortex, but people are beginning to say, hey, there's a lot of other information coming in. Touch goes in there, like Braille goes in to understand it. Visual systems comes in deaf people for, you know, understanding visual information for communication. So it's like the epicenter of understanding communication, not just auditory, which is what the label that was put on in the first place. This big cleft here is called the Sylvian fissure or the lateral sulcus. And this is like a huge chasm between the temporal, frontal, and parietal lobes. And the reason I put it there is because if you've got something going on here, you can look on the surface and say, well, this is bigger on the left side. Therefore, must be something going on here. And so a lot of people in the literature and in paleoneurology, which I'll tell you about, the evolutionary, the brain history, using that kind of information. And the big greenish arrow is because this is a very important area for the association area, and that's the big talk I'm going to give you about this area of the brain, because it used to be thought for so many years that this is like the epicenter and unique to human. It's almost like, you know, the language organ anatomy here. So now if you just think back, there's your left hemisphere. There's that big cleft, the Sylvian fissure. Now just take the hat off. Just remove the whole brain and leave the top surface of the temporal lobe and take a look at it. You flip it over. Now you look here and you look here. Look at the big difference in size. This is the first time, really, that anybody had really seen such a huge difference in the left and right hemisphere of the human brain. It just happened to be a language association area. And from that day on, everybody figured, all right, this is what we've been looking for. This is the language organ anatomy. It's unique to humans. Beautiful. And everybody believed it, even me. So now you're looking here. This is the same slide you just looked at. What I want to do, though, is just turn it on its side so you can see. So now's the front of the brain, the back of the brain. So this now, so imagine this is your left hemisphere. You took a slice. Here's the right. This tiny little thing here and this humongo thing here is the planum temporale. Everybody said it's unique to humans. The planum temporale was a human thing. That leftward asymmetry really captured the human condition. And nobody challenged it. Sure, a lot of studies looked at the chimpanzee brains and the orangutan brains and said, oh, the Sylvian fissure is a little bit longer on the left side, so therefore then something must be going on. It's kind of amazing that nobody really bothered to look and see if the planum temporale, nobody lifted up, opened the Sylvian fissure. And you know, now just before we go into business, I put this together. I thought it was fascinating. Again, we're back on James Arthur here. And this is now, these numbers refer to how old he was when, you know who this guy is, anybody? Nice beard, right? Charles Darwin. When he made his big book, The Origin of the Species, this dude was 17 years old. So James Arthur was just a young lad. He was there. He was like, you know, listening, obviously being influenced by these incredible things that were going on. He was 19 when Paul Broca made his big splash about Broca's area, 32 when Karl Wernicke. And Brodmann, the guy I told you about, the German guy who put numbers in all the different areas of the brain, he was 63 years old. So he'd seen all of this stuff. And by all intents and purposes, he was very interested in evolution and the brain. That's why he ended up being at the Museum of Natural History. And then he died, unfortunately, 2 years later. Fred Tilney came into town, and he just finished writing this classic text with his left hand. He was a righty, but you remember he had this lesion that made him a Broca's aphasic? So 2 years, he learned how to write with his left hand so he could write this groundbreaking book from the brain from ape to man. And then to give the first lecture, the James Arthur Lecture Series. That's a beautiful story, how James Arthur came to make this impression. So now let's get down to some little bit of business about how you think about brain evolution. And here's another god, George Gaylord Simpson from Columbia University Museum of Natural History also. And so homology is key to everything. When you're looking at, you know, evolution, you have to really have a good handle on what's real and what's not. But the other thing that he did, George Gaylord Simpson, was he put together beyond the normal gross anatomic rules, you know, going from the mandible to the middle ear bones of reptiles, that kind of stuff. But he put together things that were specific to the brain. Now, if you just look at these, like gross morphology, you can look at the big picture of the brain and tell what's what and whether you can follow it back to the evolutionary history of that structural relationship. This goes to the same thing, the sulci and the gyri. You remember I showed you the superior and inferior frontal gyri? But then you get to the cellular level, which is where I'm going to take you a little bit today. This is already, this has already been done by Terence Deacon. And then development. This used to be a big no-no for homology, but nowadays it's being accepted a lot more, because if you really concoct a good tasking regime, so you're going to give an ape or a monkey something to think about and what part of the brain is working it, then you can start saying, well, actually, that makes a lot of sense for homology, you know, hypothesis testing. So I've been involved with a little bit of that work too, but it's good just to see the list. All right, so now the old tree, the family tree of the primates. This is the anthropoids that I'm going to focus on here. What this little thing here means is like the division, the common ancestor right here between the old world monkeys and everything else, apes and humans, and the lesser apes too, Pongidae and Ilobatidae. That's the lesser apes and the great apes and humans and their ancestors. You go to the next level, and I'm going to take you to, is right here. And that's now between the apes, the lesser apes, the great apes, and humans and all of their ancestors. Now let's take off from here and shoot down and see what's going on. This is the story I'm going to tell you a little bit about, the brains and the language area kind of homologies of gibbons, orangutans, gorillas, and chimpanzees. I don't do bonobos because I couldn't get a good sample for those, and compare those to human brains. It's just like to throw this in a little bit to show you there are some fossils, but not too many. Once you get up here, Shivapithecus, kind of loose, but it's considered one of the ancestors towards the orangutan lineage. But there are not many fossils. In Proconsul, that's the ancestor of all of the apes, it's thought. Egyptopithecus, that's like the anthropoid ancestor. I'm so out of line if I've got some evolutionary primatologists here, but this is just like a shoe-in to understanding those relationships. But now let's go to this one. This is where, and you see who did this little picture here? Ian Tattersall. And so now these are the fossils. And a lot of the people looking at brain evolution, not me, I look at living animals, this is kind of what you're looking at right here. You take off from here, these drop off in another evolutionary lineage, and then you pick up all these ancestors after the common ancestor with bonobos and chimpanzees took off around 6 to 8 million years ago. And then all of these species come up here. And that's where I'll show you a little bit how you look at that. Essentially, people have done a lot in monkeys too, but most of those fossils are those endocasts right here, the immediate ancestors from like 4 million years down to present. They're not fossil brains. You probably know this already, but they're actually called endocasts. So what they are, it's like a natural endocast is when the fossil, the pre-fossil, the individual died, went into some mud, the brain left, you know, putrefied, left the brain case, and it filled with mud, and it made a cast of the inside of the skull. That's called an endocast. On this beautiful specimen here, you can see a lot of the features of the brain that in that mud endocast of the inside of the cranium have left quite a lot of information. Ralph Holloway from Columbia, Florida, University of Witwatersrand in South Africa. This is a beautiful fossil. Look at that one. And so they have talked a lot about brain language areas. The evidence is not as good, you know, as it could be in a living animal. Obviously, you've got a fresh brain in your hands. Here, it's a bit of a struggle to really do the best you can, but they've made giant strides in talking about particularly Broca's area as being shown to be present in these fossils. But the biggest contribution that has been around for quite a while is you can get a volumetric of the size of the brain relative to body size, so relative brain size, in most of these specimens and compare them to living species such as chimpanzees, Australopithecus africanus, Homo habilis. And look here, here's the size of the brain. Homo neanderthalensis has a bigger brain than we did. So if we're going to say bigger brain, smarter, which is total baloney, then you say, oh, Neanderthals must have been smarter than us. Well, maybe they were, maybe they weren't. But the point is, if you look at brain size, you can't just hang your hat on it too much. Now, here's Ralph Holloway from Columbia. But when I was young, in graduate school, he wrote this piece called The Reorganizational Hypothesis that was so powerful, it really influenced a lot of the way my thought was directed. Because what he was talking about, not fossils, which is his main forte, but he was talking about how the brain took a basic platform and just modified itself based upon that platform into a new direction. So nothing was changing except organization of those already existing parts of the brain. It was a beautiful paper. And it wasn't a testable hypothesis. It was mostly just like an idea, but it really took off. And now, Ian Tattersall, associative evidence. And that allows you to look at what's in the archaeological record from these wall art objects to these beautiful, you know, sculptures. And you can really get a feel into the mind of the specimens and, sorry, the species that are doing this kind of behavior. And where Ian likes to leave it on that one is he loves Neanderthals, but he thinks that Cro-Magnons were the ones that really started to blossom into that kind of creativity and that kind of cultural bloom that equaled language or full-blown human language, which I think is a great idea, except, you know, I think that language doesn't have to be spoken and it has to be driven by cognition. So now I'll take you on a path down that road. Now, this guy is Kanzi, an amazing bonobo. He named me the Orange Man when I went to visit him in Georgia when he lived there. And he uses ways of communicating, lexigrams, I'll show you in a minute. But the reason he did that was I took him a bucket of clementine oranges, just like a little gesture to say hello, and he loved it. And so now what do I mean by considering the perfect brain? Well, if you think about it, look at this, the human brain, chimpanzee brain, nice and tight. This is blending into the wall. Here's a monkey brain. This is a macaque brain, nice and tight. That brain, we can pretty well say, has been around for like 30 million years in a relatively unchanged condition. The chimpanzee brain, common ancestor, we can say like 6 to 8 million years ago, that's not long in evolutionary time. This is the recent thing. If you remember that chart I showed you, the Tattersall chart, we haven't had that brain very long, so it hasn't finally hit the big solution. So what I'm looking at then is inferred evidence. And what I did here of a recent collection, it was raised in captivity, and this is Patrick Hoff from across the park there that has a beautiful collection. But you can just see now, if only somebody had cracked open the Sylvian fissure and looked here, this is the left side, frontal, occipital, temporal, you would have seen that there is no difference between the chimpanzee brain and the human brain. Let me walk you through. All right, so here, this little bump here, that's Heschel's gyrus. That's where you're hearing me right now, whether you're right-handed or not. Here, this big thing here is the planum temporale. I'll never forget the day I was down in Washington at the NIH with my friend Alan Brown. He's the chief of speech and hearing there. And we were like going nuts for like years, taking out these specimens from the Smithsonian, putting them into a high-res MRI scanner, see if we can just like tease out, maybe, we were saying, maybe there's a really little bit of asymmetry that hasn't been caught before. And then Alan goes, we were sat around with the brains on the table, having our coffee in the morning. And he says, all right, let's just take a look, you know, just in case we can see something. And we cracked open the Sylvian fissure and we almost dropped our coffee. This is like mind-blowing. It can't be right. You know, let's get another brain out here. We've got all the brains out of this collection and it was the same story all around. It blew our little minds. So this is what we developed from that one. Language errors in the human brain have a long evolutionary history. Not just because of what I saw in the chimpanzee brain, but I figured, all right, let's take it as far as we can go with it. I think it's been around a long time. Obviously not human language, what we're using right now. We're talking the precursors of those kind of areas of the brain that are being used for communication. And this is where polymodal communication comes in. That's a really hot topic in the literature right now, and it's called multisensory. It sounds a little odd, multisensory, but it means the same thing. So modality means sign, how you doing, time out, gesture, everything that's coming into the brain. And the take-home message of this one is the brain doesn't care how the information gets in or goes out, so long as it understands everything that's being conveyed. So it doesn't have to be spoken, heard. It can be gestures. It can be, hey, how you doing? It can be anything. The brain doesn't care. But what does matter is that it's in tandem with cognitive sophistication or cognition evolution. They have to come as a package deal. You can only talk about or communicate about as much as you know, as my granny used to say. So let's take a look. There has to be something going on here. I left this deliberately closed. This is what you want to see here. That's the hypothesis. There you go, planum temporale. All right, so now let's go back and look at what you already saw at the beginning. And that's the Geschwind and Levitsky story. Very large planum temporale on the left, much smaller on the right. Wernicke's area right here, all the way around here. Angular gyrus, supramarginal, remember? Association areas. This is a nicer picture. Shows you in blue, like my shirt. All right, so this is what we were faced with. Beautiful chimpanzee brains. We had a nice collection of like 18 of them that we were going crazy doing MRI scans on them. And then we cracked them open. And this is what we saw. That's when we almost spilled our coffee. Because if you look on the left side, what you're going to do is go here, HG. This is the primary auditory cortex where you hear a pin drop or an ambulance going past on both sides. It doesn't care about the side. It's just a hearing thing. But when you get association going, you hear speech, you pass it over here, you want to understand it, you start going here, supramarginal, go all the way around. This just means descending limb, ascending limb, another study. But this is where you want to be. At least it's the first part of where you want to be. This is the right hemisphere. You see how big that is? You look here, a nice big fat Heschel's gyrus, and this rinky-dink little planum temporale. And that was consistent in just about all of the brains that we looked at, except for one, and that was this one. So what we did was we made a kind of a landmark thing here that just lay on the top, conformed to the surface, and we went through all of our brains. And they were all, except for this one, that was greater right on the, than the left, which falls right into the human condition. And you know what? It goes beyond the human condition, and we got into a lot of trouble because we published in Science 2, like Geschwind and Levitsky, 30 years later. And so the reviewers killed us, but then it was such, they couldn't fault us, and so they published it. And it was changed everything, because we showed this, that this homologue in the chimpanzee was almost identical, more so asymmetry than the human condition. And it was very nice to think that, you know, we had a common ancestor 6 to 8 million years ago with living chimpanzees today, and that common ancestor had the same morphology of language areas of the brain as we do in living specimens today, ourselves, that is. The question is, what were they doing with it? And what are they doing with it today? That's one of those big questions that I couldn't answer and still haven't been able to answer. That's a very tricky question because then you have to get into the mind of another species, and that's next to impossible. Unless you're Dr. Doolittle, then you've got it made in the shade, but it's not easy to do. So polymodal communication, you have to assume that. The chimpanzees are very sophisticated communicators. It's not just the ooh-ooh stuff. You know, it's not vocalization. There's a lot more going on than that. So this ancestral language region that we assume had to be in the common ancestor gave rise to the different kinds of communication repertoires in those two species, ourselves and living chimpanzees. Now this guy, he jumped out of the woodwork when we made this article. And it wasn't so surprising. It was in Newsweek, you know, all over the place. But there's a history of his love of chimpanzees, too. If you know his ancient history of his show, he's always got chimpanzees coming on board. But this is a funny statement. So they found striking similarities between men and chimpanzees in the part of the brain that thought to cover language. Women, you know what this means. There is now hope that one day men will be able to communicate, maybe even express their feelings. But I don't want to jump the gun. So that's all he said, but it was a nice little thing that he laid out there. Question is, did it start here? So, you know, in that paper that we wrote, we were like so excited. We just got it in the literature. You know, we were like, but then we said, all right, let's go back a little bit. Let's look at some gorillas and orangutans and gibbons, see what's happening there. And eventually we'd get to other monkeys too.
So we looked at gorillas, and this was mind-blowing as well. Now, if you look here, this is the same thing. This is the left hemisphere. So you're looking down here again, much as you did in the chimp. Huge Heschel's gyrus, huge. And then a huge planum temporale. And the story goes on. It was in gorillas too. So the common ancestor of humans and gorillas were showing the same morphology. Now let's look at orangutans. What's the story there? So we just went down the ape road, essentially, looking at all of the apes. And this is where it started to get a little bit dirty. So chimps, gorillas, solid, identical to humans. Orangutans, though, it kind of got all over the place. We weren't really sure of the morphology. It wasn't as clear-cut as in the other great apes. So that's kind of what we finalized our opinion on. That was kind of an intermediate stage of the expression of that morphology. And so we could say it sort of started here. It was beginning to show signs of that morphology happening in the orangutan, but it wasn't as clear-cut in the other species, as in the other species. All right, so now let's go to the lesser apes. And this is where the party stopped, or at least the gross anatomic party of these brain language areas. Now, I was thinking, my off-the-cuff hypothesis was that siamangs would be more likely to show it because they have these huge, long-distance communications. Look at this hyoid here. They're just swollen up, and woo, they can go like a long way with their booming vocalizations. So if anybody is going to show this, it's more likely to be the siamangs. Turned out to be just the opposite. These nice little gibbons. They had a little bit of Heschel's gyrus activity, you know, voluminous here, here a little bumpy, but there was no sign of any asymmetry in the planum temporale. And the siamang was just as flat as a board, much like monkeys. So the party was over. And look at this brain. You're really not seeing that convoluted profile like you see in the great apes and in humans. So we concluded that all of this expression, this gross anatomic expression anyway, started around orangutans. Well, now we want to enter our interspecific communication. This is a good friend of mine, a farmer from outside of Cambridge in England, where I worked for a while, and Sid, stud pig, great guy too. These guys were so tight. And I almost felt like I could talk to Sid. Ted, you know, always down the pub talking to him, but Sid was a very cool pig. He would walk down the village street and everyone would say, hey, Sid, not hello, Ted, but hello, Sid. He was a famous pig. And then Kanzie and Susan. So Susan Savage Rambo is the quick story I want to tell you about what we tried to do with Kanzie. So we had all of this great evidence of great ape, you know, language areas. And we all knew about Kanzie and his proclivity towards using these lexigrams, which are communicating English language to Sue. He used to send graduate students out to go get food for him using lexigrams. And he goes, sure, Kanzie, we're out of here. We'll be right back. And so now let's see if we can crank this, get this working. Be a high risk.
Banana?
Banana.
Very nice.
Banana. Banana.
Can you find peanuts?
Peanut.
Thank you. Will you find eggs?
Sherman. Egg.
Good. Can you find milk? Milk.
Milk.
Good. How about apple?
Apple.
Very good. How about Sue?
That's Kanzie using lexigrams. He's pretty good. Look at that. He observed his mother, Matata, who couldn't do it. So it was, you know, he wasn't being trained to use them. He just was watching his mother do it, and he just got it. All of a sudden, the Rumbaus realized that we have a bonobo here who's like a genius, so they brought him into the study. He was just a little guy at the time. And he has a large vocabulary, as you can see, 600 words, and he can comprehend spoken human language. Now, watch this one. This is really amazing. So she's putting the mask on so he can't see other cues.
Kanzie, could you cut the onions with your knife?
Got the big screen.
Well, that's very good. Thank you. Could you cut the onions with your
knife?
Could
you put some salt on your ball?
Just watch his face. It's really funny. What am I supposed to do?
Well, that's very good. Thank you. Well, that's a good job.
That's very nice.
Could you put some salt on your ball?
Kanzie, can you put the pine needles in the refrigerator?
Well, that's a good job. That's very nice. Thank you.
Kanzie,
can you put the pine needles in the refrigerator?
Kanzi, are you listening? Could you put some soap in
Good
the
job.
Water?
Thank you.
All right, so what we tried to do then, based upon that kind of stuff that he'd been doing with the Rumbas for so many years, I look upon Kanzi as like the cross-specific vanguard. He is able to communicate with us. So we're not really going to him with this one, or the Rumbas are not. They have like brought him up since he was a little baby, thinking he was a human, pretty much. So they've humanized him, and he get a lot of flack from the behavioralists for doing that. But it's an incredible experiment. So what we tried to do for a number of years and a lot of money was to try and get Kanzi as a true model. When I talk about putting together a good study, you can have a lexigram-using ape. You know, an ape who understands a lot of novel sentences in human spoken language. He's like the golden subject for this kind of study. We were going to put him in a PET scanner, and our hypothesis would be that when you present all of these kind of tasks to him, while he was in a scanner, you would see what part of the brain was being activated. If it was the asymmetric regions that we'd identify as anatomically, then we could say, okay, not only are they anatomically like humans, but they're also functionally the same as humans. It doesn't always happen. But unfortunately, that study didn't work out too well, so we moved on. Then we moved to old world monkeys. So what there is in monkey brains is a homolog called area TPT, temporal parietal transition region, which is no, but it's a cellular homolog as opposed to a large gross anatomic one. What I did was you get this block of tissue out of a monkey brain, you cut sections through it, and what you see is this. This region here, area TPT, the homolog of the planum temporale of great apes and humans in monkeys. And it's like so easy to see because you've got these huge cells right here, pyramidal cells that are characteristic of that region. So, you know, there's good criteria going back to the original thing that I showed you about how to use this information to understand homologies. So we looked at those regions of the brain on the left and the right. And this is where Nancy over there, who was my collaborator at the time, she's also my wife, electrophysiologists look at this region and they assume it's static. What she showed was there's so much variation, it's all over the place. So she looked at that cellular signature and she made these pictures, and we published this in Brain Research recently, showing, be careful guys, it's everywhere. But the big part of this study was we showed cellular asymmetry. So we had no gross anatomic asymmetry in the monkey brain at all. It was just as flat as a board. You start looking at the cellular level and you can see there are huge asymmetries at the cellular level of that homologous area. And now look at chemistry. Is there neurochemical asymmetries as well that follow the same trend? Of course there is. You know, it's like we could do no wrong. Wherever we looked in this region, there was asymmetries all over the place. Now, pavalbumin, that's like a very, it's like a neurochemical that modulates activity of different regions of the brain. But if you look at the layers, as you go down a slice of cortex, cerebral cortex, look at the difference. When you do a signature, it's called immunocytochemistry. When you put a label on it, it's so asymmetric. This is a control. This is TPT on the left and on the right. It couldn't be more different. Now look at GABA. That's like an interneuron neurochemical. Look at this. No matter where you look at in this region, what you have to assume is something is very different on the left and right hemisphere. Otherwise, everything would look just the same. You've got the homology. You look left and right, and you're seeing massive differences. And now calbinin. This is the big take-home one, layer 2. This is a very active area of the brain. Very little stuff going on right here. Humongo activity in that part of the brain. But check it out, on the right hemisphere. So it just proves I'm unbiased, because it doesn't always have to be left. So to wind up, cytoarchitectonic tomography, the Keck version of that story, cytoarchitectonic volume, asymmetry in the monkey brain, very similar to the gross anatomic asymmetry in apes and humans, and winding up with a chemo architecture. Now, the trouble with this is you can describe it, and it looks wonderful and everything, but what is the meaning of that asymmetry of the chemo architecture? Yeah, it's asymmetric, but unless you know the exact workings of that neurochemistry, you can't really put a significantly meaningful story together. It's just a description at this point. But what you can do is, if you know what that neurochemistry is involved with, especially in humans, you can try to start to translate a story that would fit into that descriptive data. Finally, with the big adaptive shift, or as I put it, a major adaptive shift. But if you go onto Google and search major adaptive shift, you won't find it. And believe me, I looked. I heard it once. It sounded so good, and I use it. But it's usually just an adaptive shift. Things begin to change very rapidly. And when they change, you've got a trajectory in place that things happen very quickly. And what you're looking at here is the grand old Rift Valley. And, of course, again, from the grand man himself. It's a good little read, right? It's very difficult to decide how far changed conditions such as climate, food, have acted in a definite manner. There is reason to believe that in the course of time, that effects have been greater than can be proved by clear evidence. Well, that fits right into the story I'm about to tell you. Because this is equatorial Africa. The common ancestor of humans and chimpanzees likely lived in equatorial conditions. Then the Rift Valley started to mess with their beautiful bounty of foods. So they had to, like, deal with it. So they had to cross the rift. They had to go out there. They have, like, normally living chimps have, like, these defended territories with no man's lands in between. They're very, you know, they don't like to have strangers deal with them. So what happened, though, around that time was this. The Laetoli footprints, you'll see them in the hall there. And that's where it happened, right in the middle of the Rift Valley. There's not many resources here. It wasn't a great life. So here it is. Doesn't look that appealing, does it? So if you wanted to, like, do business, instead of, like, the lap of luxury the living chimpanzees have got in an equatorial tropical environment, food all over the place, you had to go out. You had to learn how to become bipedal, and that was the major adaptive shift. Bipedalism drove everything. And it tells you a lot about things, too. If you had to travel great distances to get resources or whatever, you better, like, become bipedal, and that has to happen quickly. That's not like an overnight phenomenon. I mean, it has to be an overnight, relatively overnight phenomenon, because if it's not perfect, it's going to be like a flat-footed person not being allowed to join the armed forces, because you can't walk great distances. It may have happened quickly. You know, I'm not going to go there because this is so controversial, but I would propose that bipedalism gave rise to high levels of cognition and the language that came with it, because you're going to be out there in the Rift Valley, like these guys, and you better learn how to communicate. You're not already in a less sheltered little territory. You're out there meeting strangers, and you better learn how to deal with strangers, otherwise you're dead meat. Once you, like, made that shift into bipedalism, language and cognition came with it. This is not my idea. People like, you know, Terence Deacon and many more have done that. But I just, like, love the story, so I thought I'd share it with you. And so now there's Kanzi again with the imperfect brains. And he's saying we can't speak yet. He's thinking it. He's not saying it. He's using lexicograms to do this. So let's start with gestures. You know, time out. Okay. The multisensory brain doesn't seem to mind, and it really doesn't. A lot of people have proved that the brain really doesn't care about how the information comes into it. And that's, you know, going back to Ralph Holloway, which reorganizational hypothesis, another person who really kind of inspired me was Gordon Hughes, and he got a lot of flack at the time when he published this study, the primate communication and the gestural origins of language. It made so much sense. It's a beautiful paper, so well written, and I met him a few years later before he died, and it was so nice to hear it from him, you know, the ramifications. And people like Michael Corballis, it's pretty hot right now. It wasn't back then, but now people like Corballis have picked it up. And this is, I put this here because the way he talks about it is like a behavioral fossil that really captures the dynamics of what gestures are. And I think I have to agree with Michael Corballis on that one. I couldn't resist putting this one in because, you know, Ian is such a great writer, so you've not read any of his books yet. I totally recommend it. They make a good read. And he's written a lot of books. He loves Neanderthals. He loves Cro-Magnons. And if you want to get into Tattersall's mind, you have to read his books. Now, finally, this is just the usual list. And the reason I put them in green here and here and here and here, because these are the previous people who'd given this talk. Alexander Marshak, who I talked about, he's no longer with us. He used to be here with his wife every year. I used to say hello to them. The lady I've been telling you about throughout, who did a lot of this work too. So thank you very much, guys.
Giving due credit to James Arthur, whose generosity back in 1928, I think it was, allowed us to start this this amazing series. And now Patrick has agreed to field any questions, if any of you have some.
That wasn't a planted question. That's a tough question. Well, I guess where my research is going now is, I give a huge lecture about this, but I was in the constraints of time. And we have a study going on right now at the NIH, me and Alan Brown, who I talked about before. And we have, like, we're comparing gestures, everyday gestures, like check please, time out, what's going on, you know, the whole package. There are so many gestures that we're all familiar with on a daily basis that we just don't think about them that much. So we're comparing everyday gestures in speaking, hearing people to American Sign Language in deaf, totally deaf from birth individuals, which have been shown to activate the same parts of the brain as spoken heard language. So that goes back to the polymodal, all the multi-sensory story. So we're looking at all of these variables, the different kinds of gestures, different kinds of signs, spoken heard on top of that. And, you know, it's like we can do no wrong. Those papers are coming out in NeuroImage, the journal NeuroImage, very soon, which have shown, no surprise, the same parts of the brain are being used. No matter what you pump into the brain, it goes there. If it's communication, high-level communication, those association areas are using the same part of the brain. And on the left hemisphere, the right-handed left hemisphere story. You know, that's a good question. And that's one of my many dreams. Yeah, the question was, is there any study of like gestural communication in non-human primates? And there are people working on that. In fact, there's a lady at NICEP, which is a CUNY program here, who's looking at that. But it's like a needle in a haystack phenomenon, because, you know, we're looking at other... It's such a subtle communication form, and that you hear so many anecdotal stories that it really does exist in apes in particular, where all of a sudden you're looking at a group of them, a troop of great apes, and something happens. Nobody saw it except for them. Because we're so into our own little thing that no matter how much we look and how much, you know, facial expressions we look at and document, it's almost impossible for us to go there. And people have talked about it. Jane Goodall has talked about it. Roger Fouts has talked about it. So it does exist. But to untangle that mess and for us to put our heads into it and to understand it, I take my hat off to whoever achieves that. It's very difficult. Yeah, I mean, I haven't actually gotten to do that, but, you know, it becomes a descriptive... Yeah, yeah. Have you considered doing, like, the genetic version of the neurochemical asymmetry in living primates? And, yeah, there are so many paths you could go down to look at those kind of variables, but you're always going to end up at the same place. And you can, until you can discern functionality, you know, that is species-specific and be very clean about it, you can't just hoot, you know, vocalizations of them out of context in the wild, because it's like, you know, you go, woo-hoo, you know, like, you should never underestimate the intelligence of a non-human primate, because you see so many published studies, it's, you know, not quite what you're talking about, but just like they're delivering vocalizations to like a martial eagle. They're sat in a functional imaging chair, and they're piping in a martial eagle, and you really think the monkey is going to think, oh, I better watch out, there's a martial eagle coming down right now. Like, get real. It's not like that. So, but then again, to get to that level, how are you going to do it? How are you going to look at neural activation? Current technology doesn't allow it. Well, you know, that has been the gene sequencing of language areas. That's rudimentary. You know, published studies have already been done on that one. And I think they use Tim Crow, I believe, and his group have looked at schizophrenia as a model for that. And he, you know, anybody know Tim Crow? He said that schizophrenia was a price we paid for language, because things were happening so fast, cognition and communication, that we became, the proclivity for schizophrenia suddenly appeared. And he thinks schizophrenia is unique to humans. So he used that genetic signature to look at that. So you should, if you're interested, look up Tim Crow. Yes. Yes, ma'am. And what was the last part? Oh, in music. Yeah. You know, well, the person, she was asking me about what is the story with music and polymodal communication. And Robert Zatori is the guy who's doing that, the Montreal Neurological Institute. And check it out. Perfect tone musicians show more asymmetry of plenum temporale than non-pure tone musicians, which really upset me because I love Jimi Hendrix and he couldn't tune his own guitar. So he had to get somebody in to tune his guitar. I mean, he was a brilliant musician and songster, but yeah, so anyway, that's in process. And look up Robert Zatori, and it's a good story, actually. Yeah. Yeah, they are. In humans, anyway, we haven't looked at great apes. They're present at birth in humans, and the story goes there. They're already there, but then other people say, well, you know, humans and anybody are hearing full-blown everything from the first trimester in utero. So, in other words, if you want to say, well, it's not, in birth means nothing, really. You're already hearing everything. You're hearing language. You're hearing tonalities. And if it's starting to happen, but you'd have to lock a pregnant woman in a soundproof room for the entire, you know, period of, you know, development. So you couldn't test that one. But yeah, anyway, they are present at birth. Yeah. So endocasts in Neanderthals. Yeah, well, you know, the story with that goes is that they do have Broca's area, but then again, so do chimpanzees. So that literature, I hate to say it, is not really much value, except to say that it shows a progression, you know, in the brains of Homo and Neanderthals and Habilis, and all of those. It's a progression of development. Because you can say, all right, in the chimpanzee, you can say, okay, it's the same as humans, but things are happening at the same time. Chimpanzees don't have a brain as large as Homo habilis or Homo erectus or Neanderthalensis and sapiens. So things are coming as a package deal. So you can't say, no, it's meaningless because chimps have it. Therefore, it's meaningless that Neanderthals or Homo habilis had those areas as well. Ralph Holloway talks about expansion of the parietal cortex, which is a huge association area. So when you start putting those pieces together, you realize that it's not just one piece that really makes a big difference. You know, it's the package deal as you cruise through the, you know, the Homo and Australopithecus, you know, trajectory. I've questioned you out. Oh yeah, Bill Hopkins has looked at bonobo brains, and they're exactly the same. And he's the guy who looks at handedness and tries to correlate that. That's one of the big mysteries of all time. So bonobo brains, bonobos are very different. If you look at the work of Franz de Waal, you should read his books. They are mind-blowing. They're so different to regular chimpanzees. But their brains are pretty much the same, but their behavior is different. So, and their communication skills are quite different, too. They're like the peacekeepers of the ape region. They like just let anything happen. They're so calm, you know, compared to the chimpanzee. They're different. But anyway, to answer your question, the bonobo brain, they're identical. And he started to do some functional imaging, very rudimentary, Bill Hopkins, on chimp brains. But that just goes back to, like I said, you play a martial eagle, you really think the monkey is going to freak out because he's sat in a chair, you know, in an imaging machine. That's not context-driven. And that's going to be the biggest step we make, whether it be in a bonobo, a chimpanzee, or a monkey, is how to bring context to the next step. Okay. Well, you know, the outliers, I guess you have no outliers, unless you take it to the hylobatids, any of the lesser apes. You know, it's not like a regular evolutionary trajectory that you have the specimens available. So you can't really plug in an outlier that easily. And you're following what's called a transformation series. You assume it's a transformation series. And that what it means is like a stepping stone version, which you normally would use an outlier to say it's not there. But what I have to do is look at living representatives of an evolutionary trajectory. And that's what, you know, like Simpson talks about this, a transformation series. This was step one, step two, this piece was added on, this piece was added on. And that's the best you can do with a comparative approach. You don't have the luxury that you have like in a fossil approach, where you really can just slip in an outlier. I could slip in my family dog and say that's an outlier, but that would be meaningless, you know. So you have to keep within the constraints of at least that group of primates. So any ideas for me on that? Oh, yeah, well, that's true. So asymmetry could be anything, really. Like I showed you with the neurochemical asymmetry, there's no assumptions that it's going to be on one side or the other. The discovery there was the sides are doing something different. But that is so loose at this point. I can tell you no stories that go with that finding. And that would be an outlier too, I guess, but it's not anything I would brag about. Yeah. Well, actually, you sat next to a great book right here. Leslie Aiello and Dean Falk put out A Symmetry of the Primate Brain. And I think that, is that true? It captures just about everything you would need to know. So talk to Leslie. She'll give you a, go on Amazon and look up her name. You'll find it. How about that for a sales job there? I published in that book too, so I'm promoting it for that reason too. Yes, Dr. That's not being done, but you know what came to my mind? That's a great question. What came to my mind on that one was, there's a period of time during human development, you're born with all of these areas already there, asymmetry in place. But if you have like a disease like otitis media, where you have impaired hearing at age 2 through 5, which is when it starts to happen, and nobody picks it up, you're just not hearing. And what you're missing are critical periods of development. So everything's in place. You're starting to learn language. You're starting to understand language more than the goo-goo-gaga crowd, you know, the 1 and 2 year old types. So you're actually picking up, learning how to associate it, but those things are still developing. The pieces are in place, but they're not fine-tuned at that time. So that kind of fits into that story. If you miss that critical period, there's no going back. So if you've got middle ear disease at that time, you're going to be in trouble. You're not going to be having the same level of early development. And it's like a big deal. You know, otitis media, if you have kids, you've been there. It's all over the place. And the fact that some parents could even miss it and not notice that a child wasn't hearing very well, that's like, it's not exactly what you're saying, but there's nothing really along the lines of what you just described. This lady does, you know, a lot of hotshot work in, you know, pharmaceutical, you know, stem cell research, but there's nothing really being done in that region of language areas, and that's just one example how it can go wrong. The story goes like this. We developed an incredible relationship with Kanzi. And it's like, you know, you've got to, I hate to put it in tune with what happened the other week with that chimpanzee that hurt the lady, but they are wild animals. They're not domesticated. Even Kanzi, brought up thinking he was a human from birth, he's still a wild animal. I hesitate to say animal. He's a wild person. But you can't predict his behavior. If he gets bored with something, no matter how much you work to make it happen, when he says it's over, it's over. And so we had him so souped up. We had masks. We had a special astronaut chair for him. Like, everything was cruising. You know, he was doing really good. He was loving everything. One day, he woke up. He just didn't want to play with us anymore. And you're not going to force Kanzi to play. You know, he's like, you don't mess with that guy. So anyway, that's why. But he would have been incredible, you know. That would have been a perfect study. He was ready to cruise. We were going to fly him up in a helicopter to Washington. You know, it's just to make life easier for him. I'm not kidding. Anyway, yeah, you had one. Yeah, well, you know, the homologue, the cellular homologue, came from the human study by Galiberta. He proved the asymmetry of PT was related to that cellular signature. So that's where we picked that up from. We said, okay, if that's making all that asymmetry, gross asymmetry, let's look in the monkeys who are not grossly asymmetric. And that's where we showed that, in fact, it was asymmetric at the cellular level, but not at the gross level. So no one has really done a big, because it's a huge amount of work. And to get the specimens to do that, anybody want to do it? Hey, I'd love to see it's done. But that's a good point. Now, I think I would say that I would say you're already seeing the trajectory. If it's in monkeys and it's in humans and you're seeing the asymmetry at the gross level in chimps and other great apes, I would imagine you're going to see the same thing. Well, you know, that's a good point. So the density of synapses across the cortical areas, we did a study of that. Nancy and I did that study with a molecule called synaptophysin, which tells you how dense the synapses are. But then you fall back into the same problem. You say, all right, you've got a dense band of synaptic activity on layer 3. That's where a lot of information is coming from different areas of the brain, even the opposite hemisphere. But so what? It's way cool to look at it, and it's great to talk about it, but what does it mean? So we hung ourselves up by we're seeing so many different things like that, synaptophysin, and calbindin, and GABA. You know, it's all over the place. What do you do with it? So we stopped doing it for a while. We ran out of money from NSF. 'Cause, you know, Well, yeah, it is important, actually. In humans, it's very important. Maybe I didn't make that point well enough. Is that activation of those regions is predominantly on the left hemisphere if you're right-handed. If you're left-handed, it goes across the two hemispheres and almost always to a large proportion of the time to the right hemisphere. So it's called functional asymmetry. So those areas are larger, and they're also the seat of spoken heard language in most human brains. 70% of human brains are right-handed. They're going to be on the left hemisphere. So, yeah, it is important in that sense. Yeah. Yeah, you know, they do. But whether it's at the population level, meaning some chimps do show hand preferences, but there's like an equal... And Bill Hopkins, he's the guy who does this at Yerkes. And I don't believe they have handedness, but he believes they do. But when you bring it to population level, which means do the majority, like 8 out of 10 of individuals show a preference for the right hand, I don't think they do. No one's really proved that very well. And definitely not in monkeys. They have a reaching preference, this for food. Does that make it handedness, or do you have to have really fine ambidextrous skills, you know, threading a needle, throwing a dart? That's dextrality.
Right. Well, look, thanks again, Patrick. That was marvelous. And thank you all for coming. And don't forget, if you want to be on our electronic mailing list, just email the address that's posted on your right on the way up. Thank you all.
This has been the 79th James Arthur Lecture, delivered at the American Museum of Natural History. You can see listings for upcoming public programs like children's workshops, members' field trips, and other events on the calendar at www.amnh.org. The mission of the American Museum of Natural History is to discover, interpret, and disseminate through scientific research and education knowledge about human cultures, the natural world, and the universe.